Hello and welcome. This is Was Bitcoin Bringt, the Bitcoin podcast from Vienna, Austria, presented by Coinfinity. Today, we're going English again with a very interesting interview with Brent Johnson. He's the CEO of San Diego Capital and the creator of the dollar milkshake theory. A theory that explains perfectly why the dollar keeps on rising and rising and rising while all the other fiat currencies are falling and falling, even failing. We're talking about his vision of the future, what is to expect from the global debt situation, are we going into a global debt crisis even? And of course, we're talking about the role of gold and Bitcoin in the future. A short message from our amazing sponsors, and then we get right into the interview.
Incrementum is an independent asset manager, a fund manager, and a research firm based in Liechtenstein. The Incrementum partners Ronald Stöffele and Mark Waller are experts on the topic of sound money and the Austrian School of Economics. They published a legendary Ingobi Trust report, where I am also an author. Find them at incrementum.li.
I'm sitting here with Brent Johnson, the CEO of San Diego Capital. Hi, Brent.
Hi, how are you? Nice to see you.
Thank you for taking the time. You are the inventor of the so-called dollar milkshake theory, and we're going to talk today about the chaos in the global markets, a sovereign debt crisis that I think you are seeing coming up soon, the energy crisis, Russia, Europe, whatever. But one question I want to start with, because this is for a European audience, can you explain to us what a milkshake actually is?
Sure. Yeah, so a milkshake is basically a dessert drink. It's like a whipped up ice cream so that it's like smooth and you can actually drink it rather than eat it. And, you know, some people put chocolate syrup in it or strawberries or whatever it is. I like them just plain vanilla, but that's what a milkshake is.
It is a very American thing, isn't it?
It is. It kind of goes, I think, back to the 50s or the 60s. Yeah.
Your main call has been for many years, you know, everything will flow into the dollar. Yeah. Can you elaborate on this and how it relates to the milkshake?
Sure. So I think the important thing to understand is to understand where I'm coming from when I explain how and why I came up with the milkshake to begin with. And that is, my job has been for the last 25 years to manage money for individuals. And the individuals that I manage money for are very smart. They're very successful. They could probably manage the money themselves if they were interested in doing so, or if they had the inclination to doing so. But they're either busy running their businesses or living their life or doing something that they are interested in as opposed to finance. And so they aren't necessarily up to date on all the lingo and the terminology and in the weeds of what goes on in the global financial market. So whenever I sit down to them and kind of explain to them what I think is going to happen or what we should be doing or why we should be doing it, I oftentimes have to come up with a very simplified way of explaining it. Because if I start talking about credit default swaps or interest rates and monetary policy, you know, it's not that they're not smart enough to understand, but it's just not their, it's not their realm that they typically deal in. So I always have to come up with a simple way to explain a very complicated topic. And I've done this my whole career. And, you know, 3 or 4 years ago now, it seems like forever, I started on this whole dollar milkshake thesis as a way to explain to them what I thought would happen. And it's taken a little longer to play out than I thought it would, but it seems like it's playing out now. We'll see whether it continues. But the way I explained it was that I think a lot of people, particularly Americans, are aware of the fact that the U.S. government has been profligate for too long. They've spent more money than they made. They've built up this enormous pile of debt. They did it while interest rates were very low, and now that interest rates are going to rise, you know, we can't afford to service the debt, and we're going to have the central bank come in and buy it all, and we're going to have to print a bunch of money to pay off these debts, and therefore the dollar is going to lose its value. And I think that was a very kind of common theme coming out of the global financial crisis and then coming out of 2018 and especially out of COVID. But what I tried to explain to my clients was why that may eventually happen. The issue is that currencies trade relative to each other. And if we were the only government and the only country that had these problems, then the dollar would absolutely lose value. But the problem is that every other country is in the same boat or has a similar problem. And as a result, and not only do they have a similar problem, but they may have even a bigger problem, and they don't have all the advantages that the U.S. has. Now, I think some people may disagree on how many advantages the U.S. has, and I think a lot of people would disagree that they deserve them. But whether you think they should have them or not have them, in my opinion, the fact is that they do. So you have a situation where all of these countries are in the same situation. They all have this bad hand that they've been dealt and they have to deal with. But only the U.S. has all these advantages. And so the way I explained it was these advantages that the U.S. has are like a straw. And the way that the governments around the world have tried to deal with all these problems over the last 10 or 15 years is they've printed all this money, or they've mixed this milkshake of liquidity and capital. But because the U.S. and the Federal Reserve has the straw, we can put our straw down into this global milkshake of capital, and we can drink it up into our economy and our dollar. And I got the idea from a movie called There Will Be Blood. And in this scene, there's an oil baron who's negotiating a piece of land with his neighbor, and his neighbor really wants him to buy this piece of land. And he says, if you buy my land, then you can have all the oil that's underneath it. And the oil guy says, you know, I really don't need to buy your land. All I have to do is stick a straw down into the ground and I can drink your oil. And he says, I can drink your milkshake. And so when I saw that, I thought that made a lot of sense. And I thought that was a good way to explain what I was kind of seeing coming down the road. And that's where it comes from.
It is quite ironic. You're sitting in front of a European map, right?
Yes.
So what you're basically saying is that, yes, everybody's printing money. Yes, money's getting debased. But as long as everybody's doing it, the U.S. still has the best system and the best currency. And in the end, people will choose to go to the dollar.
That's right. And it's a little bit of, because the market has been built up this way over decades and decades, there's a network effect. The whole world uses the dollar. The whole world needs to use the dollar. There's two other parts to it, though, but the design of the system has the dollar at the base. So the whole system is kind of levered off of the U.S. dollar. The dollar is the collateral off of which everything else operates. So if you have a system that needs to if it has too much debt and it needs to delever, it makes sense that the underlying collateral will rise in value as those debts come down, or as that malinvestment comes down. And that's part of the reason why I say the dollar will be the last to fall. It's not that the dollar is immune to these problems, and it's not that the U.S. is this exceptional place that can get away with all of this and we will never have to pay the price. It's just that there will be a progression of people paying the price, and it's my belief that the U.S., for better or worse, will be the last one that has to pay the price. So that's part of it. And then the third part of it, so part of it is the design of the system. Part of it is the network of the system that's been built up over the number of decades. But then the final thing is that the U.S. is still the global superpower. And, you know, we still have the strongest military. And you can argue maybe it's not as strong as it used to be, or maybe there's all these problems. But, you know, that's what global reserve currencies are about, who the global superpower is and can they enforce their will on the rest of the world. And I think largely that's what the U.S. does. So if anybody tries to get out from the system or to get away from the system or undermine the system, then the U.S. will try at least to punish them. And I think that's what you're seeing now with Russia, Iran, some of the other countries that have sanctions put on them. So it's kind of a multifaceted straw. There's many pieces to the straw.
Has the straw now been put into the milkshake? Has the U.S. started sucking?
I believe so. I think that's why you're seeing what you've been seeing. You know, another part of the straw is that I was of the belief that the U.S., not that the U.S. can raise rates and not have any problems. Again, I want to make it clear. This isn't a situation where things are great in the United States and they're bad everywhere else. It's a relative game. Things might not be great in the U.S., but I think they will be even worse everywhere else. So on a relative basis, I think capital will seek out the United States dollar and the U.S. markets. And I also believe that if there's going to be any global growth, the little growth that there will be, I think, will be in the United States. I don't think we will have a situation where the U.S. goes into a recession and the rest of the world grows. I have a hard time seeing that happen. It's not impossible, but I have a hard time seeing that last for any period of time. And as a result, I think the U.S. can raise rates, or what's the right way? Probably a better way to say it is we can raise rates to a greater extent than the rest of the world before the problems hit. And so, to your point, is the U.S. sucking up the milkshake now? I think that they are, because as they raise interest rates, it makes the dollar more attractive on a yield basis. I mean, if you think about it, just a couple of years ago, you couldn't get paid anything to own a 1 or 2 year treasury. It was zero or just barely positive. Now you can get 4% to hold a U.S. treasury. Now, 4% isn't amazing, but compared to where it was 2 years ago, it's a lot better. And so that makes it a relatively attractive place for global operators to park capital. And again, if you're an individual, in many ways, you have the option to just sell everything you own and just put it in cash and go hide somewhere, or put it in gold or whatever it is. But if you're a global corporation or some kind of an institution that operates on a global level, or if you're an asset allocator that runs a big pension fund, you don't really have the option to sell everything and just go sit in cash. There's many reasons why that's just not an option. So they are the people that really move big capital that then influences overall markets don't have the option to just go to the sidelines. They're going to put their money somewhere. And so when they do that, I think that the U.S. and the U.S. Treasury is a more attractive option than perhaps an Italian treasury or a Canadian treasury or a Mexican treasury or a Brazilian treasury. And I think that will remain the case for some time. So that all of these things are the straw that helps the U.S. kind of, survive this crisis a little bit longer than everybody else.
It seems like, and you started by explaining that you have to explain difficult financial things to people who don't necessarily want to know every detail, right? Mm-hmm. But right now, when you look at, you can explain this without using any financial lingo, because we have war in Europe, we have this basket case that is the Russia-Ukraine European situation, yeah. We have China doing whatever they're doing, I don't know what they're doing, but it doesn't look good. Mm-hmm. So it's rather easy to explain why the U.S. is the cleanest shirt right now.
That's right. And I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things that I've kind of experienced as I've kind of talked about this, theory, is the number of people who push back really hard on it. And to be honest, at first, I wasn't shocked that people pushed back, but I was a little bit surprised with the determination with which they pushed back, and the forcefulness that they would say that the U.S. is no longer the safe haven. And I think a lot of it has to do with perhaps desire versus reality. And what, yeah. I mean by that is, I'm the first person to agree that perhaps the U.S. is not seen as the same way it was 20 or 30 years ago. You could make a very good argument that rather than the global white knight, we've been the global bully. Rather than solving the world's problems, we've caused the world's problems. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that's not a possibility. That's definitely a possibility. And so I think there is perhaps a desire for the rest of the world, or many institutions and entities around the world, to get away from using the dollar as the global reserve currency. But it's one thing to say you want to get away from something, and it's quite another to be actually able to do it. And one of the other simplified analogies that I have used to kind of explain this is, I don't know if you have kids or not, but I have kids, and it's kind of like your 7-year-old Mark coming out of his bedroom with, he throws a few toys in a backpack and grabs his pillow, walks to the front door, and he says, "I'm running away from home because I don't want to clean my room, so I'm running away from home." And it's a very nice statement, and he's very confident. But the reality of him actually getting very far and being successful in it is pretty low. And so it's not that I don't understand the desire, and it's not that I don't have faith in my son's ability to, be successful in the world. But just because somebody gets up on stage at a financial conference and says the BRICS are going to launch this parallel currency, and within a year or two, everybody's going to leave the dollar and they're going to migrate to this new basket of currency and it's going to work fantastic, it kind of strikes me of my son standing at the door telling me he's going to run away from home. Sure, it's possible, but the likelihood of success, I think, is much lower than is often given credit for.
I've spent a lot of time with these stories. The BRICS, yes, but also the Europeans. I mean, the Europeans have been trying to move out of the house for decades sure. now. They're sure. not seven yeah. anymore. They're maybe 17 now. but it seems to me that with the censoring of the Russian currency reserves, with going with the US yeah. on this, it seems to me that this dream is totally dead now. The idea of using the euro, Juncker talked about this in 2018, using the euro as a tool for European sovereignty, talking about the US, of course.
Yes.
But it seems to me that this is over.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, a little, I'd say over the last couple of years, as, you know, even before COVID, when we were still kind of struggling with the effects of the global financial crisis and trying to get, you know, global growth back on track, you know, the currency crisis we're having now, but the energy crisis we're talking about now, people have talked about this for years. It's just being acute now, but this isn't like an unknown thing that just happened out of the blue, right? And so I think there's a little bit of, you know, people would say that the euro was going to either be the competitor to the dollar, could potentially replace the dollar. But the reality is that, again, and sometimes people don't like it when I say this, so I apologize if this is offensive in any way, but in many ways, the Europe is subservient to the United States. Now, I'm not saying it should be this way. I'm just saying it kind of is. You know, NATO is, you know, Germany, Italy, France, Spain, they've all got their own armies or the militaries, but it's very small compared to, you know, the NATO presence. NATO and the U.S., for better or for worse, kind of runs NATO, right? And so the whole European security system is interlinked with NATO. So for Europe as a whole to either take on the dollar and replace the dollar or break away from the dollar, that would kind of mean also breaking away from NATO and breaking away from the U.S. security blanket, for lack of a better way of saying it. And again, I'm not saying this can't happen, but the point is the linkages between U.S. and Europe are much greater and more than just friendship. Like, entire systems are kind of put together. And so, you know, a couple years ago when people would tell me that because of this potential energy crisis and because Europe kind of wanted to get away from the dollar, perhaps Europe would align with Russia and China against the U.S. And again, I think I understand the desire and I understand the interest in that being like a thought idea or, you know, interesting idea to like think through. But when it gets kind of down to the brass tacks or the real politic of it, you know, in many ways, the U.S. provides the protection for Europe or is a big part of the protection for Europe. So for Europe to, you know, align with Russia and China on energy policy rather than with the United States on energy policy, it's a very, very big decision. And again, I think it's much harder to make that decision and actually be successful with it than just saying that you're going to do it. And so, and I think we saw that earlier this year, right? When Europe was kind of, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine. And I'm sure, you know, there was many people in Europe, and they still are saying, you know, we really need this Russian gas. We really need this Russian energy. But I'm sure the U.S. was saying, hey, we don't want you buying Russian gas. We don't want you buying Russian oil. And, you know, surprisingly, and for many people, you know, most of Europe, the EU, even Switzerland sided with the U.S. on this and placed sanctions on Russia, confiscated the assets, locked up the accounts in the banks. And so it's a pretty clear delineation that they chose the existing world order and the existing, you know, alliance with the United States over aligning with Russia and China. So it I know we're kind of jumping around on a bunch of different topics, but I really think all of this is related. This is kind of the big game, for lack of a better word, right? It's not just economics, it's geopolitics, it's military, it's political alliances, and it's, you know, we've kicked this can down the road so many times that now we're coming up on not just one can, but all of these different cans. We've been kicking all these different cans down the road for years, but now we're getting to where all the cans are piled up. And so we're hitting multiple different problems at the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, it's geopolitics, it is energy, it's military. I mean, the currents, you talked about the dollar being the base of the system, right? And this goes back to 44, to Bretton Woods, even before that. But 44 was the moment when the US basically decided for the world that this is how this is going to go. Because that's when the US was the only country who had the bomb, first of all, and also the only country that was still, you know, standing. I see what you're saying. I mean, I'm sitting here in Vienna, Austria, right? So the radiator you see back there, it's a bit warm today. The gas is coming from Russia. Yeah. Where is it coming from? It's coming from Austria. Was the first country in Western Europe to buy gas from Russia in 1964. 64. And we are neutral. We're not even in NATO. But when it comes down to it, we would still expect the US to defend us.
Well, and I think one of the things that's been really interesting for me, my progression as an investor, and it kind of relates to a lot of the stuff we're talking about today in my discussions with other people who disagree with me, is that I think if you're talking about these topics and you just want to kind of think about them and what the different possibilities are, that's one thing, and I think that's a worthy discussion. But if you're allocating assets in order to either protect yourself against what's coming or profit from what's coming, to a certain extent, you need to set aside your desires and your wants and the way you would like to see things play out, and really just kind of focus and hone in on what's actually going to happen, right?
What is going to happen?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but what I think is going to happen is that these crises that we've talked about, that they are going to accelerate. And I think that when we hit these crises, when I look back over the last 25 or 30 years, whenever there's a crisis, the dollar rises versus other currencies. And it kind of makes sense, because if there's a crisis, the underlying collateral should rise. And I think that the problems that we have now, the combination of geopolitics, military issues, trade issues, supply chain issues, energy issues, internal political issues, and monetary issues, we have all of these issues that are kind of hitting at the same time. And I just don't think that the leadership that we have, not just in the United States, but around the world, is up for the task of solving it. And so it tells me that while we will probably get through it and the sun will come up tomorrow, that volatility is most likely going to rise versus the way it has been, right? And as volatility rises and as crises happen, then the dollar typically rises. And when the dollar rises, then bad things typically happen in financial markets.
Because, emerging markets topple over and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. And what has happened over since the global financial crisis, there was kind of a unified approach to the global financial crisis. Everybody around the world kind of did the same thing. And then every time between then and now, especially during COVID, whenever a problem popped up, it was very quickly squashed by the monetary authorities. They'd either launch another QE program, or they'd launch a stimulus program, or they would do some new thing that kind of tampened down that volatility. But I think we've just gotten to the point where that it can't really be tamped down anymore. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say they can't kick the can down the road for another 2 or 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, but I think it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to keep the volatility under wraps. And part of the reason is a lot of the tools that were used, let's say between the global financial crisis and the COVID crisis, a lot of it had to do with putting more money into the system. Well, that was fine when the system was it experiencing deflationary pressures or lack of rising prices? But now we have the opposite. Now we have global inflation and we have these inflationary pressures that are causing problems all over the world. So if we go back, if the monetary authorities were to go back and use the same tools they used in, you know, the last 15 years, and they use them now, in many ways it will exacerbate the problem that is inflation rather than help it. And so it's not as easy for the politicians and monetary authorities to deal with what they've already been dealing with for the last 15 years.
But you recently wrote that even if the US goes back to QE, even if they go back to printing, the more they print, the higher the US dollar will go. Can you explain this?
Yes, mainly it kind of goes back to the dollar underlying the system. And the fact that, okay, so this, it starts to get a little complicated here, but I'm going to do my best to kind of keep it simple. The US dollar underlies the entire system. As part of that, the reason, part of the reason that the dollar underlies the whole system is that we have the strongest and the deepest and the biggest consumer economy in the world. So all these countries that are not US sell their goods into the United States, right? So as a result, these other exporting countries don't want their currencies to be too strong because then it makes it harder for them to export to other countries and into the United States. So if the US starts to go back to QE and the dollar falls, initially that's fine because it relieves the pressure. But if the US relieving the pressure makes the dollar fall, and it, then it makes those other currencies rise in value. And as those other currencies rise in value, it does put pressure on their exports. It helps, as the US dollar falls and interest rates come down, it helps the input costs of these other countries. It helps them go down, so the input costs aren't as high. But the problem is the top line revenue comes down as well, or has the potential to come down as well. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, these countries, they also have to do QE. Because again, remember how I said we can't really go into a situation where the US slows down and has to go back to QE, but the rest of the world is growing and has to raise rates. It just doesn't really work like that. And so if the US starts cutting rates and starts going back to QE, then these other countries are going to have to do the same thing in order to remain competitive. And so the more the US does QE, then these other countries, maybe not right away, but let's just use the last 2 years since COVID as an example. Initially, the US came out, they did QE in a big way, they were the fastest, they were the biggest, they were the most powerful. And initially, the dollar fell, right? But then the US started to recover and the US started to, you know, stop printing. They started talking about raising rates. And then they raised rates a little bit, and now they've raised rates a lot. Meanwhile, the rest of the world is still, in many ways, supporting the bond markets either through QE or stimulus programs. And I think if the US came out and did QE again, the same thing would happen. Initially, the dollar would fall. Oh, but I forgot to say, you know, despite after COVID, the dollar went from like 102 to 90. That was a big pullback. But here we are just 2.5 years later, and now we're back at 112 or 110 or whatever it is. So yeah, it worked initially, but it didn't solve the problem. It just kicked it down the road, and now we've come up on that can again. I think if they went back to QE right now, then the same thing would happen again.
Coinfinity is Austria's first Bitcoin broker and your partner for the long-term Bitcoin strategy. They have excellent support and fair prices, and a focus on customer satisfaction. Coinfinity is a firm run by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. You can find their physical store in the city of Graz and reach their website from everywhere, coinfinity.co.
Not your keys, not your coins. If you want to take responsibility and take your Bitcoin into self-custody, the Bitbox O2 by Shift Crypto is the smartest choice. It's simple, safe, open source and made in Switzerland. And there's a reason why the Bitbox is now the most famous hardware wallet in Germany, Austria and Switzerland. We know about saving money for the long term. There's a Bitcoin-only version as well, and with the code FIXTHEMONEY in one word, you get 5% off when buying a Bitbox O2. Check it out at shiftcrypto.ch/fixthemoney.
Okay, and before we come to the sovereign debt crisis and to how this will all resolve itself, what's the situation with inflation in the US right now? And are we going to expect more inflation down the road for the next years?
Many people think that inflation is entrenched and it's going to stay here forever. And I think that's possible, but I'm not convinced that that's the case. And I really don't care whether we have inflation or deflation. Both of them are equally problematic. And I don't think that we have the tools to solve either one of them particularly well without causing volatility and chaos. But I think in many ways, because the inflation that we have now is supply chain driven and as a result of the military conflict between Russia and Europe and the fact that the US and China are not cooperating the way they used to, I think it has the potential to last longer than some people think. The flip side is that I also think that the deflationary pressures are building up in places like China, like Europe, and like the US, where debts are getting harder to service. If the debts get defaulted on, then that's a deflationary pressure. So I feel like the world is walking on a razor's edge between inflation and deflation. And I think what's going to happen is we'll probably get a little bit of both. In other words, we'll get stagflation, right? Mm-hmm. Some things will fall to the left and the inflationary pressures will stay very high, and other things will fall to the right and we'll have these deflationary pressures. And that's the hardest thing, because how do you deal with it? Again, the monetary programs that a central bank could launch to solve an inflation problem will exacerbate a deflation problem, and vice versa. So they can't solve both of them, right? They can only solve one of them. And I don't know which one they're going to solve, but whichever one they decide to save, I think is going to cause problems in the economy.
Do you have one specific problem within the monetary architecture, within the economy, that cannot be solved without, is there one specific thing that you think about?
Yeah, and I think I'm glad you brought this up, because this is really kind of a core piece of the whole thesis, and I haven't even talked about it yet. And that is the global debt, and not just global debt, but the global dollar denominated debt. Now, I think most people know that the U.S. has borrowed a lot of money. I think this week we've passed $31 trillion or something like that, right? And it kind of passed by when nobody gave it much notice. But, it's well known that the U.S. has a lot of U.S. dollar debt. What's less well known is that there's more U.S. dollar debt issued by non-U.S. entities outside the United States than there is inside the United States.
That's the euro dollar, right?
That's the euro dollar market. And this is kind of this opaque, nebulous spider web of U.S. dollar financing that takes place outside the United States that isn't regulated. And since it isn't regulated, nobody has to report on it. And since nobody has to report on it, nobody knows how big it really is. But what we do know is that 25 years ago, when somebody tried to measure this, it was much bigger than the U.S. The U.S. dollar market was much smaller than the euro dollar market. And based on the way the system is designed, the system has to grow. If it doesn't grow, it collapses. So if you think about how much the U.S. system has grown over the last 25 years, you know that the euro dollar market has had to grow even more. And so the point, this gets back to the U.S. dollar debt. The reason there is so much demand for the U.S. dollar is there's so much U.S. dollar credit out there. If you borrow in dollars, you have just created future demand for dollars when those have to get serviced and paid back. And so I over the last couple of years, as I've talked about this and how this is an incredible demand for dollar, and this is part of the reason the dollar will fall last, I've had a number of people say to me, well, all the rest of the world has to do is just default on these dollars. If they default on these dollars, then the demand is no longer there. And if the demand is no longer there, then the dollar falls. The problem with this argument is that it's not the U.S. that loaned the rest of the world money in dollars. The problem is that the rest of the world loaned the rest of the world the money in dollars. So it's a French bank extending dollar-based credit to Turkey. It's a Brazilian firm, it's a Brazilian firm, trading with a Japanese firm in dollars, and they extend them credit for the invoices that are coming. It's the shadow banks when one bank borrows between another bank and it's denominated in dollars. And if the size of this market is incredible. And so if all of this US dollar debt got defaulted on, yes, you would get rid of the demand. The problem is one entity's liability is somebody else's asset, right? So if you think of it like a house, and the house, you discover, you know, you've lived in this house for 30 years and you've built onto it a little bit from time to time. But then all of a sudden you discover that, you know, this isn't really working anymore. You know, people are getting sick in the house. They're not feeling very well. They're like, what's, and then they go up and they look in the attic and there's this green mold all over the attic. Okay. Well, how do you get rid of the green mold? Well, to get rid of the green mold, you have to burn the house down. So yeah, you can get rid of the mold. The problem is you destroy your house in the process of getting rid of the mold. And so it's, again, it goes back to, it's not that the desire is not there, but to actually be able to do it is much harder to do because you're going to cause pain in the short term. So you know, there's not the money to pay off all the dollar debt, and you can't default on it, because if you default on it, then people and entities start losing assets. And if people and entities start losing assets, then you start defaults again. And just like in the global financial crisis or in March of 2020, when defaults start happening, all of a sudden it creates this big crescendo of one default creates another default, creates another default, and pretty soon you have a global crisis.
Because when you say the dollar is going to fall less, so where is this going? Are we just going to, because if the house, if there's mold in the house, you cannot live in the house anyway, so the house is already destroyed.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? Are we just going to hyperinflate one currency after the next?
So I first of all, I don't know for sure. My thesis is that what's going to happen, and what we're already starting to see happen, is that the periphery economies will come under pressure first. And you're already seeing this in places like Sri Lanka, like Peru, Ghana, Turkey, you know, Venezuela, Argentina. Venezuela and Argentina are kind of the perennial places this happens. It seems like every year they have a monetary crisis, but you're starting to see it in other places. I mean, you're now starting to see it in places like England. The Bank of England had to intervene in their market, and the Bank of Japan has had to intervene in their market, and China's intervening in their market. So you're starting to see it not just on the really periphery, you're starting to see it move towards the core, and it moves close. Eventually it will get to the US. Again, I want to make sure that people understand, it's not that I think the US is immune to it, I just think it's a progression. So what I think will happen, I think we'll see very high levels of inflation in the periphery economies. I think it'll start working its way towards the global or the core economies. And eventually, I think we will get to a place where the monetary authority, first of all, this isn't going to happen in a straight line. I think this is going to play out over a number of years. I don't think this is going to be done by Christmas or even Easter, right? I think this is probably going to take two, three, four, five years for this all to play out. And there will probably be probably be periods of dollar strength and then dollar weakness and strength and weakness and kind of back and forth. But I think ultimately it will get to a point where the dollar is so strong and these problems are so widespread that the monetary authorities will be forced to come together and figure out a way to reset the whole system. Whether it's another Plaza Accord where they write the dollar down, you know, kind of multilaterally, or whether they get together and they say, okay, all the debt that's on the central bank balance sheets, that we're going to have a debt jubilee and that's all gone, and it allows them to keep playing the game longer.
Well, that's what Christine Lagarde said, right? It will come down in due time. It will come down. But how? It will come down.
Yeah. But my guess is that based on history tells me that governments are never proactive in getting these things solved. They always react to a crisis because you kind of need the crisis to give them the political authority to make these grand moves that it would take to solve this. You know, if they came out today just out of the blue and said, we're going to reset the whole system and all of your standards of living are going to decrease by 50%, you know, there would be riots in the streets on every continent and every city. But if there is a crisis and people are losing everything and they can come out and say, hey, we're your saviors, we're going to help you, it's much more politically allowable for them to do that.
So coming together and just, you know, striking the debt would be like a hyperinflation, but like done in one day, basically. But I mean, has this ever been done on a global scale? And how is anybody going to protect themselves from this?
That's a very good question. I hope I'm successful in protecting ourselves against it. I think the first thing I'd say is, I think the best recommendation I can give to people is to, if you have any preconceived ideas of what is absolutely going to happen, you should throw them in the trash cans. You should not be certain about anything. Now, I have high levels of conviction, but I'm not certain about anything. I don't know for sure that I'm going to be right. And so I try to just understand what all the different possibilities are and what's actually going to happen and be prepared for what's going to happen. And I think this crisis is going to happen. So the way I prepare for it is I own gold. I think everybody should own gold. I don't think gold's going to pay off right away in dollar terms, but I think it'll pay off sooner in yen terms and euro terms and, you know, Turkish lira terms and Brazilian real terms. So I think everybody should own gold. I think everybody should own some real assets of some kind. I think everybody should have some cash. I think if you're not a U.S.-based investor, well, I think everybody, even if you are a U.S.-based investor, I think you should have some cash. If you are not U.S.-based, I think that cash should be denominated in dollars rather than your home currencies, because I think the dollar will go up versus other currencies. Despite all of the craziness in the stock markets, I think we'll probably have more pain before this is all said and done. But on a relative basis, I think U.S. stock markets will do better than European stock markets or Asian stock markets. So to the extent you want to have some equity in your portfolio and you don't live in the U.S., I think I would be investing in U.S. equities as opposed to local equities. And part of the reason is, if you think about it, and maybe you've heard me say this before, but let's pretend you live in Turkey, as an example, right? And you buy Coca-Cola. Okay, so Coca-Cola, let's pretend Coca-Cola doesn't go anywhere in U.S. dollar terms. It just goes sideways. Well, Coca-Cola pays a 4 or 5% dividend. And if the Turkish lira continues to lose value versus the dollar, let's say it loses another 10%. Well, now you just made 14%. Which is not too bad if you're living in Turkey, who's got very high inflation, right? And if Coca-Cola happens to go up a little bit, then that's kind of a bonus on top of it. But I just don't think there's a situation where the rest of the world does really well and the U.S. does really, really poorly. So I think the way you protect yourself, and this is kind of why I think I'm kind of talking my book, but the reason I'm talking my book is because I think this is the way the book's going to play out. I think as investors and asset allocators kind of think through these issues, they will put their money in the United States or U.S. dollar-based assets. And I think as more and more people do that, U.S. dollar-based assets will perform better than the rest of the world. So if people are listening to this and saying, how does Brent think that you should protect and prepare for this, is I think you should be looking at U.S. dollar and U.S. dollar assets as a way to protect against it.
Short term, do you think the dollar is still going to go higher?
The short term is really tough. You know, it made a high of like 114 last week. We thought it had gotten a little bit ahead of itself. You know, at that point, everybody's saying, oh, the dollar's going higher. And that's never a good sign when everybody's on the same side. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if the dollar pulls back. It's already pulled back, you know, 3 or 4%. Wouldn't surprise me at all if it kind of stays at this level or even trades down over the next couple of weeks or next couple of months. But what I would tell people is that if the dollar does pull back over the next couple of weeks or next couple of months, I would use that time to prepare for the dollar to then go higher rather than thinking that was it and now the dollar's days are done. That's kind of what happened in COVID. You know, in March of 2020, the dollar made a high and then it sold off pretty hard over the next 9 months or over the next year. And I think a lot of people said, okay, that's it for the dollar. It can only go lower. And rather than use that dollar weakness to kind of either pay off their dollar debt or get out from underneath the dollar system, they doubled down. They issued more dollar debt. They borrowed more in dollars. They did more transactions in dollars. And as a result, that demand for the dollar eventually picked up. And then here we are again, kind of right back in the same place. So that's my recommendations.
So your most important recommendation was don't be sure you know what's going to happen, because nobody knows and the future is uncertain. That's the most important.
That's the most
second important. Most, the second most important is dollar-denominated assets, gold. And then the question, of course, what about Bitcoin?
That's always a really tough one. This is the one I struggle with the most, because I personally like Bitcoin, which I think is kind of surprising because a lot of people have heard me talk negatively about it. I think it's an incredibly beautiful dream is probably the best way for me to say it. If you think about all of the attributes that make either Bitcoin or gold a good form of money, you know, portable, easily divisible, you know, fungible, can't inflate it away, can't be destroyed in deflation. All of these reasons that make money, make gold or Bitcoin a good store of value for an individual, is all the same reasons that the governments hate it, right? And so I think that as we get further into this crisis and governments, you know, get into trouble, both their bond market and their currency markets, they are going to have to do drastic things in order to protect their government bonds and their currencies. And history's been pretty clear that when their own currencies get in trouble, they try to attack competing currencies or anything that kind of infringes upon their monopoly. And I think gold and Bitcoin would probably find themselves in those crosshairs. And there's a lot of people who've told me that, well, there's nothing the government can do to stop gold or Bitcoin. And I think that that's incorrect. I think there's a lot of things they can do to stop it. Now, ultimately, I think gold will go. I think gold is the ultimate winner here. I think that's several years down the road, but I think gold is the ultimate winner. I don't know if Bitcoin will. I think it probably will not. So while I think it's, again, a beautiful dream, I think that's what it is. I think it's a dream. I don't think it's likely to actually succeed.
But why would you? Because you said that they're going to attack gold and Bitcoin. They are already attacking Bitcoin on a daily basis, basically. Yeah. They're not so doing so with gold. They own gold themselves, of course. But why would you say that?
Well,
that gold is going to win, not against Bitcoin, but against the governments.
Well, I think probably the best way to say this is that I don't think that we're going to go back to a gold standard. And I don't think we're going to go back to a situation where gold is remonetized. It could happen. At least they won't do it willingly. But I guess my point is I think with gold has been around for 5,000 years and has proven itself time and time and time again through many crises that it will hold its value. And if you still own it on the other side of that crisis, you will have some capital intact. So while I don't think the official price of gold will ever be remonetized, it doesn't mean that gold won't go to $5,000 or $10,000. And I think gold is relatively easy to understand, and it's a physical thing. You know, Bitcoin is much different. Bitcoin, I know all the arguments are that it's very much like gold and it actually has some additional benefits that gold doesn't have. But I can tell you, until the whole world decides they want some Bitcoin, in other words, let's use my mother as an example. If I explained to her that she could go buy some gold or she could go buy some Bitcoin, and then I explained to her how she did each of those, she's going to go to gold 100 times. Because she doesn't know much about computers. She's not technologically savvy. She's walking around with this thing in either a cold wallet or on an exchange, and she has to remember these keys. And I know it's pitched as this very simple process, but it's, you know, for an older generation, it's not as intuitive as it is for the younger generation. So perhaps as the younger generation grows up and everybody that grows up with it uses digital assets, then perhaps that will be a way that Bitcoin does well. But I'm just not as personally bullish on it as many of my friends. Many of my friends are very bullish on it.
Give me a second to just dream the beautiful dream for a
second
here. Because I'm a huge gold bug. I'm a huge gold fan. No questions about that. But the difference between gold and Bitcoin is that Bitcoin really is its own monetary system that can be used on a daily basis globally, and it's permissionless, and you don't have to go to a shop, you don't have to buy any physical things. So in a situation where one currency after the other topples and we have hyperinflation on the periphery and then maybe even in the core, And everybody has a cell phone, everybody is online, as long as we have the internet, obviously. I mean, I could see people wanting Bitcoin because their currency is going down the drain.
Again, in non-US dollar terms, Bitcoin maybe do very well. I'm not convinced that we'll do it in US dollar terms. And part of the reason, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but part of the reason is that Bitcoin is basically a bearer asset. If you hold it, you own it, right? It's kind of like holding physical gold. For those who are kind of liberty-minded or self-reliant-minded or from the Austrian School of Economics kind of educated, that sounds like a really wonderful thing. But the reality is most people are not liberty-minded. Most people are not do not want to take self-responsibility. Most people, even though I don't like this, most people want a center of power that they can go to rely on when things get bad. They want to be able to call their bank if they lose their credit card. If you think about it, in many ways, years and years and years ago, money was a bearer asset. You walked around with it in your hand. And then when you could get to a point where you could deposit the money in one location, travel somewhere else and, pull that deposit out. Let's say you deposited money in France, you went to Venice and you could pull it out of a bank branch in Venice. That was innovative. That released the personal responsibility of taking that money with you. So on the one hand, having the bearer asset is really attractive. On the other hand, some people might not like it, I guess is my point. And there's no recourse. Like if you lose your Bitcoin, it's gone, right? It's like cash. If you have cash in your wallet and you lose your wallet, the money's gone. There's no recourse. And so I think in some ways, the world is headed towards more centralization rather than less centralization. And I'm not sure that Bitcoin will win that battle. I like it personally, but I'm skeptical.
Absolutely. I mean, being skeptical is important. I guess that, banks could just be banks again and hold the Bitcoin for you and you pay a fee and then
maybe.
But it's your argument about gold, because gold has the same issues, right?
So why
do you think gold would be the winner? Is it because the governments are going to sit down and say, let's go back to gold in some capacity? Is it because Russia and China are buying gold? I want to understand.
Governments, I think the genie's out of the bottle on digital assets. You could call Bitcoin the greatest beta test in history, right? It's kind of proven itself. I think as a result, central banks around the world are going to issue their own digital currencies. And history kind of tells me that monetary authorities don't like competition, right? So if you have a US dollar coin, then why do you need any other digital stable coin, right? Once the Fed issues their stable coin, there's no need for any other stable coin.
The Fed, including the euro.
So exactly. And so I kind of think that the digital asset space will get co-opted by the governments and the monetary authorities. With gold, part of the reason I think gold could win is, to your point, that they already all own it. It would be very easy for them to reprice gold higher, or if the price of gold goes higher, while it also, in the one hand, it threatens the central banks, it also sort of helps them because they all own it on their balance sheet already, right? Now, the other thing is, people always ask me why, if they don't want to go back to a gold standard, then why do all the central banks hold gold? Well, I think for two reasons. I think they hold it for insurance reasons, just the same reason that maybe you and I own it for insurance reasons. I think deep down they know that in some kind of a crisis, and if people lose faith in the fiat currencies that they own, they could use gold as a way to bring confidence back to their currencies. But the other reason I think that central banks own gold is because if you hold something, you can control it. And in the same way that governments hold Julian Assange, right? The reason they don't let him out there running all over the place is because they don't like what he says. And so if they hold on to him, they can control him. And I think that's a little bit the same with gold. If they can take that gold off the market and put it in their vaults, to a certain extent, they can use their holdings to control the market. You know, whether governments ultimately relent, I think that this fiat game is going to get reset. Now, I think what comes after fiat will be another fiat system. But there may be a period of time where governments have to use gold to make that transition from this system to the next fiat system. And in that transition, I think gold could be priced much, much higher. Maybe not officially by the governments, but at least on the black market. And I can't rule that same thing could happen in Bitcoin. I'm just less skeptical of it. Or more skeptical of it, I guess I should say.
Absolutely. I mean, the question would really be, 15 years ago, we didn't see where digitization would take us. We wouldn't know what the iPhone can do for us so that we can sit here talking. I don't even know where you're sitting. I didn't even ask you where you're sitting.
I'm in my house.
But we really don't know where digital economy is going to take us in the next 10 years. I'm personally very skeptical on central bank digital currencies. I agree with the stable coin, and that's what you see in Europe. I mean, the ECB is issuing one paper after the other, basically saying, today we're panicking about the digital yuan. Yeah. And the next day they are panicking about the dollar. Then they are panicking about stable coins. Then they are panicking about Bitcoin, because there's competition coming from every direction, and they don't know how what to do. So this is, I mean, for somebody who has been in this for 12 years or 50 years, it's funny, but it's also scary. Brent, I don't want to take up too much of your time. This has been great. Thank you for your insights. Please give us your contact details. Where can we find you? Where can we follow you? How much time do you spend on Twitter?
Too much time on all of the above. No. So if anybody wants to get in touch, if I have a website that literally just has my my regulatory documents on it and my contact information, that's at santiagocapital.com. I'm very active on Twitter. If you look me up there, it's either Santiago Capital and you'll find me. I've got the scallop shell logo. Santiago AU Fund is the handle. And if you're interested in the whole dollar milkshake theory, you can go look at my pinned tweet. There's a short little summary of it there. But then also if you Google that, or if you Google it, or if you put it into YouTube, there's a number of different links and references to it. And in the In Gold We Trust report, they've highlighted it a few times. So I think any of those places, it's a good place to get started.
Yes, yeah, so the shout out to Ronny Stöffele who got us together.
Yeah, tell him I said hello.
I will. Brent, thank you so much. This was very interesting. Maybe we can do this again in a year or two and see where we're going and where we are.
Huh? Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Danke fürs Zuhören bei dieser Folge von Was Bitcoin bringt. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, bitte hinterlasst uns 5 Sterne bei Apple und bei Spotify, folgt uns auf YouTube, schickt uns eure Eindrücke, eure Ideen, eure Anregungen, eure Vorschläge für Gäste und natürlich auch eure Kritik an hallo@wasbitcoinbringt.com. Was nicht unerwähnt bleiben darf, natürlich auch Value for Value. Dieser Podcast läuft über das Lightning-Netzwerk in allen Kanälen. Man kann streamen, man kann spenden. Es gibt einen Spenden-Button auch auf wasbitcoinbringt.com inzwischen. Und diese Dinge sind auch wahnsinnig motivierend, wenn da ein bisschen was reinkommt, wenn jeder das nutzt. Es macht wirklich viel Freude, als Bitcoiner für Bitcoiner zu arbeiten.
Die Veröffentlichungen in diesem Podcast sowie die darin enthaltenen Hinweise, die im Begleitmaterial gesetzten Links, dienen ausschließlich Informationszwecken und stellen weder eine Anlageberatung, Anlageanalyse noch eine Aufforderung oder Empfehlung zum Erwerb oder Verkauf von Finanzinstrumenten dar. Insbesondere kann eine Anlage oder sonstige Beratung dadurch nicht ersetzt werden. Die in den Veröffentlichungen erhaltenen Angaben basieren auf dem Wissensstand zum Zeitpunkt der Ausarbeitung und können jederzeit ohne weitere Benachrichtigungen geändert werden. Die Inhalte richten sich ausschließlich an natürliche Personen. Es wird keine Haftung für die Richtigkeit, Vollständigkeit oder Aktualität der zur Verfügung gestellten Informationen, Informationsquellen, daraus resultierenden Haftungen oder Schäden jedweder Art übernommen. Eine Haftung für leicht fahrlässiges Verhalten wird jedenfalls ausgeschlossen.